There are climate activists, and there are the climate inactivists, whose goal is to divide, deflect, and discredit.
The inactivists, the bad actors that we've been talking about, they would like nothing more than to see environmental activists fall into despair. Because look, they've already sort of marshaled the political right. They've weaponized them for their agenda. It would be the ultimate victory if they could weaponize at least a sector of the left for their agenda as well.
That's world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. We talk with him about his new book, The New Climate War. And later, we check in with Nation magazine political correspondent John Nichols about the fight over the COVID-19 rescue plan. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. As the evidence that the climate crisis is upon us now, the voices saying climate change is a hoax are fewer in number, a certain recently passed president notwithstanding. But that doesn't mean the fossil fuel industry or its minions have given up. Instead, they've adopted a soft denialism, one that uses divide and conquer tactics to turn climate activists against each other, deflects attention from the need for systemic change by focusing on individual responsibility, or seeks to discredit climate heroes like Bill McKibben, I'm talking to you, Michael Moore, in order to weaken the fight against the carbon pollution that threatens our survival. In his new book, The New Climate War, world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann describes the fossil fuel industry's tactics of divide, deflect, and discredit, and shows what we can do to counter them. And he pushes back against the climate doomers to give us reason to hope that we can win the climate war for a healthy planet. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. Scientific American called him one of the 50 leading visionaries in science and technology back in 2002. In addition to The New Climate War, he's the author of numerous other books, including The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars and The Madhouse Effect. Michael Mann, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
This is just a terrific book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. So you say we're in a war with those you call, and I love this phrase, the climate inactivists. They fall into a number of different groups, although the fossil fuel interests are the key ones behind all of it. Who are the climate inactivists?
Yeah, so thanks for the kind words. You know, the inactivists, as I call them, are the forces of inaction. They're the institutions, the individuals, the organizations that continue to be behind this effort to prevent us from fundamentally acting on climate, from decarbonizing our civilization, because they profit from our continued addiction to fossil fuels. And so we're talking about the fossil fuel industry, of course, but the various organizations that promote their interests, various industry front groups, dark money organizations, paid talking heads and flacks who advocate for the fossil fuel industry, who in the past were engaged in an effort to discredit the underlying science of climate change. But as I explained in The New Climate War, they have turned to a new array of tactics as denial becomes essentially impossible, because it's too obvious to the person on the street that climate change is here and it's already impacting us. So they've turned to a whole new array of tactics to prevent us from taking action. Of course, the conservative media is a very important part of that effort as well, working in essence for fossil fuel interests to really fill our public discourse with misinformation and disinformation, and to confuse the discussion to distract us, to deflect attention, to divide us, and all of these other things that they're doing to block action.
You really kind of deconstruct all these strategies of divide, deflect, and discredit. Let's take discredit first. ClimateGate. You were one of the scientists targeted by it, and I'd like you to tell us briefly about it. And this happened just around the Copenhagen climate talks.
Right.
Tell us who did it, who was behind it, and why.
Yeah, so thanks. Yeah, it's a little bit more than a decade ago on the dawn of the Copenhagen summit, which was widely seen as the most favorable opportunity in many years for the world to come together and act on the climate crisis. In the lead up to that summit, there was a massive, again, a disinformation campaign, you could call it, a stunt, a hoax that was perpetrated by, again, the inactivists, the folks we're talking about, fossil fuel interests, various front groups and right-wing media that promote their interests. And what they did, they had stolen thousands of emails off of a server in the UK. These were emails between climate scientists, including myself. And they had gone through these emails and looked for words, single words or phrases that they could take out of context to completely misrepresent what climate scientists were doing and talking about and explaining. And they used this to try to convince the public and policymakers that climate change was indeed a hoax. Look at these scientists. They use words like trick. Well, in science and in mathematics, a trick is a clever approach to solving a vexing problem. But taken out of context, it can be used to make it sound like, oh, look, they're trying to play a trick on you. And the amazing thing is that it really took hold. They were very effective. They even got mainstream media outlets to buy into this narrative, you know, the narrative of ClimateGate, which was that climate scientists really are engaged in a massive worldwide hoax to convince you that climate change is real and that we need to do something about it. And it was very effective. It really penetrated into the mainstream media, leading news networks, again, sort of in essence, promoted this false narrative that was being nurtured by the fossil fuel industry and their advocates. And it really served as a distraction at a critical time. It was used by the Saudi Arabian delegate to declare at the outset of the Paris proceedings that that Saudi Arabia would block any efforts to do anything about climate because these emails show that it's a massive hoax. I suspect Saudi Arabia actually had something to do with the theft. In the book, I've talked about the various bad actors, Saudi Arabia, Russia, who have been looking to squelch climate action, global climate action. And they probably played a role. Petrostate actors probably played a role along with the conservative media and the fossil fuel industry in this massive disinformation campaign. And it probably set us back. If nothing else, it served as a very useful distraction for them at a critical juncture, Copenhagen, where we really had an opportunity, the world had an opportunity to move forward boldly. And what, as a result, you know, we lost a decade of time, of critical time in acting on this crisis. And that's, you know, where we are at right now, things are so much worse than they would have been if we had taken action then.
And you also implicate WikiLeaks in this. And, you know, I want to say I think it's very important that Julian Assange not be jailed for the rest of his life because, you know, the implications for press freedom. But nonetheless, he is not an innocent actor in this.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's important to sort of separate those things. Journalistic freedom is critical in a democracy, and we should support that. And you know, we don't jail people because we don't like what they have to say. That having been said, it was a bad faith effort on his part. And in retrospect, it seems pretty clear that it probably reflected a collaboration with Russia, with Putin, who see, you know, fossil fuel extraction as their way forward. Fossil fuels are by far the greatest asset that Russia has. And they even see climate change, ironically, as potentially benefiting them. And Putin has said as much. They see a warming of the Arctic, a warming of Siberia as something that would potentially be favorable to them from an agricultural standpoint, from trade. And so for various reasons, Russia has been a bad actor and has interfered with global efforts aimed at climate action. And WikiLeaks has played into those efforts. And obviously, Julian Assange, as the leader of WikiLeaks, is implicated in that. And so, you know, we have to separate those issues. Yeah, that doesn't mean he should be jailed for life. But we should, you know, recognize that there are some bad actors who often masquerade as sort of liberators when in fact they're really furthering an agenda that has adverse impacts on our planet.
Yeah, and our lives.
And our lives, absolutely.
And you also bring in, this was new for me, you bring in into this kind of conspiratorial realm, and I mean that actually conspiratorial yeah. realm, Brexit and the Yellow Vest protests. So deconstruct that for us.
Yeah. So, you know, as I said, Russia is, well, you know, we know that as a state actor, they have interfered with various democracies. They successfully helped elect Donald Trump because they knew that he would take actions that are favorable to them. For example, Russia had a $500 billion oil deal in the pipeline with ExxonMobil, Rosneft, the Russian state fossil fuel company, and ExxonMobil were planning a joint venture, a $500 billion joint venture to mine fossil fuels in Siberia and in Russia. And Hillary Clinton would have continued the sanctions against Russia because of their actions in Ukraine. Sanctions that prevented that joint effort. And the Trump administration early on, Paul Manafort, in fact, had promoted at the time that the Republican platform was actually being finalized the summer before the election, he actually put in language that would remove the sanctions against Russia and allow that deal to go forward. So it's critical to understand why Russia had an interest in helping elect Donald Trump. It was because of this, effort for them to monetize the greatest asset that they have, fossil fuels. This is also why they have tried to interfere with efforts in other countries aimed at actually promoting serious action on climate, and that includes efforts to interfere with U.S. Politics and Canadian politics. But among the best examples of that are the Yellow Vest revolt in Paris, which was sort of depicted as this sort of grassroots revolt of the people by the people to the threat of taxation from a carbon tax. But in fact, we understand that it was fomented by Russia online on Facebook. They sort of manufactured this conflict in an effort to create this rebellion that would send a message, not just to France, but the rest of the world, that, we will rebel against any effort to put a price on carbon. And so it's really quite insidious what Russia has been doing. They've probably been the primary state actor in the world working to undermine action on climate. And we need to recognize that going forward, we have a change in administration now. The Biden administration will certainly take a harder line towards Russia, and we need to rein them in because that sort of political interference is once again destructive to the planet and to all of us.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann about his new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. So another strategy that you talk about is deflection. And let's start with the It's Your Fault deflection campaign. Give us some examples of that. What do you mean by It's Your Fault?
Yeah, thanks. It's really it's an important part of the message of this book. Deflection, an effort by fossil fuel interests to deflect attention away from the needed systemic solutions and policy actions to individuals, as if it's just about us behaving better rather than reining in bad industry behavior and regulating industry, the fossil fuel industry and carbon emissions. And it has its roots in past deflection campaigns. I don't know your precise generational status, but perhaps when you were growing up, as I remember, you may remember this ad that ran in the early 1970s, the Crying Indian public service announcement.
Oh, yes.
And it had such a fundamental impact on all of us who were growing up at that time. I was, I believe, 5 years old or six years old at the time that ad came out. And it just had such a profound impact. For our listeners who may not be familiar with it, it was this public service announcement. It was run by the Ad Council that runs these public service announcements about various environmental and consumer matters. It's a nonprofit, and it featured what someone who purporting to be a Native American in a headdress, in a full headdress, rowing his canoe down a river that is strewn with litter, with bottle and can litter, and eventually comes up upon the bank of the river and gets out and walks toward a highway that neighbors it, and a passenger in a car that is driving by throws a bag of bottle and can litter out the window, and it lands at his feet, and it then zooms in on his face, and you see a single tear running down his face with the tagline then and the voiceover that people cause pollution, only people can stop it. And it felt to all of us at the time very empowering, like here is this terrible crisis. We can all do something to fix it. And it felt like it had a powerful message. And it seized upon the powerfulness of Native American imagery, which at the time sort of was part of the zeitgeist of the early 1970s, the sort of mythology and the power behind, you know, the culture of our indigenous people and the plight that they face. And so it seized all of that power for its purpose. But what was its purpose? Was it really trying to empower us to solve this problem? Well, it turns out, and there were some environmental groups that co-sponsored this PSA with the Ad Council. But we later learned that, in fact, it was a publicity effort. It was a PR effort by the beverage industry. Coca-Cola and the beverage industry hatched on Madison Avenue by advertising executives, which was aimed at stopping the incipient movement to pass bottle bills in the various states, including my home state of Massachusetts, bills that would require a deposit on bottles and cans, which would encourage recycling and would solve this problem in a systemic way, but it would lead to reduced profits on the part of the beverage industry, which would have to process the bottle and can waste. And they didn't want to see these bottle bills pass. And so instead, they engaged in this multi-million dollar PR campaign, a very successful campaign to deflect attention away from systemic solutions to individual behavior. It's just about us being better citizens, cleaning up our bottles and cans. And hey, let's send the Boy Scouts out to collect those bottles and cans. That's the real solution to this problem. Well, it was very effective, and it prevented the passage of bottle bills in the vast majority of states. There's no national bottle bill today, and it left us, its legacy was one of the other great environmental crises we face today, the global plastic pollution crisis. We have the beverage industry and the crying Indian PSA to thank for that. And today, plastic, microplastic pollution can be found in mother's milk. There was just an article about that a few weeks ago. Well, the fossil fuel industry is running with that playbook. And so when you hear about how climate change solutions are really about us changing our diet and not flying and all of these individual actions, yeah, we should do these things. They're part of the solution. We should decrease our environmental footprint. It saves money, makes us healthier, makes us feel better, sends a good message to other people. Sure, we should do all these things, but it's no substitute for the needed policy changes. Government incentives to price carbon, to provide subsidies for renewable energy, to move us in the direction that we need collectively to move. So we can't fall victim to this deflection campaign by the fossil fuel industry and those promoting them to make it seem like it's all just about us changing our personal behavior. It's no surprise that the idea of the individual carbon footprint calculator, that came from British Petroleum in the early 2000s. It was part of this effort to deflect attention towards individuals so that the fossil fuel industry won't be subject to regulation.
Well, they are so diabolically clever, aren't they?
They certainly are. They've run with the playbooks of past industry disinformation campaigns, the crying Indian PSA, the tobacco industry that sought to cover up the scientific evidence. The fossil fuel industry has used that playbook.
So, as you say, it's not an either or. We both need to do that. But you also say that, in fact, that emphasis on individual action can lead to inaction. In some cases. So explain that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There is some sort of social science research that's emerged over the past year or so in some of the leading journals by experts. So, you know, there's some real science behind it that it sort of makes sense when you think about it, when you think about sort of the psychology and the way we sort of compartmentalize our lives. And we only have a certain amount of sort of mental space for, you know, for any given problem. And what the research finds is to the extent that people feel like they're already helping solve a problem, say by taking individual actions to reduce their own personal carbon footprint, it sort of reduces their enthusiasm for taking more action. And so, you know, if you feel like, hey, I'm already doing, you know, enough, leave me alone is sort of the sentiment. If you're already focused on individual action, it can actually sort of crowd out your emotional support and enthusiasm for, say, promoting systemic solutions. And that can mean speaking out about it or talking about it or voting on it or what have you. And so it's important for us to realize that it can actually lead us down this very disadvantageous path. So there's a fine line. Again, we should do the things that are easy enough for us to do that decrease our environmental footprint. Of course, we should do that. But the more we emphasize that that's the solution, the more it sort of de-emphasizes the need for systemic solutions. And so that is what the social science research indicates. And it really reinforces the fact that we have to push back against this idea that individual action alone is somehow the solution to the climate crisis.
Yeah, and it's not the only thing that it does doesn't just deflect. That and other methods being used are divide and conquer methods. So talk about divide and conquer and wedge issues as a strategy. I mean, for example, meat eating.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting. You see the synergies in these different tactics, right? Because we just talked about the deflection campaign, deflecting attention away from systemic solutions to individual behavior, like what we eat and whether we fly. That also plays into one of these other tactics, which is divide and conquer. Because to the extent that they can make this about individual behavior, it plays into behavior shaming, right? Pointing fingers at people who you don't think are displaying, you know, the carbon purity that they should, and getting people arguing with each other about their individual behavior and their lifestyle choices. What better way to divide people, right? So it is very effective in dividing the community of climate advocates, getting us fighting with each other and arguing with each other so that we don't present a united voice demanding action. And it plays into yet another tactic, which is the effort to discredit opinion leaders, thought leaders, celebrities who have devoted, you know, their lives to promoting the climate crisis and the need for climate action. Folks like Al Gore, Leonardo DiCaprio, who have been very prominent in sort of the climate campaign. And the critics love to go after them by focusing on their supposed hypocrisy, supposed aspects of their lifestyles, their energy consumption, that somehow paints them as hypocrites, undermining their effectiveness as opinion leaders and as their effectiveness as proponents for climate action. So it isn't coincidental that you see them going after Leonardo DiCaprio, accusing him of being, you know, a jet-setting celebrity who doesn't, walk the walk, and therefore we shouldn't listen to anything he has to say about climate change because he's a hypocrite. Well, in fact, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio has devoted, you know, his life now to promoting public awareness about this issue. And, you know, you have to live within the system that exists. And he works within that system to do what he can to raise awareness about the problem. You know, Al Gore, they went after him, literally going after his weight, as if his weight somehow, you know, paints him as a glutton. You know, he eats too much. Well, you know, that's really sort of a low blow. And, you know, I've met him. He's as, you know, fit, I would say, as, you know, most men of his age. And, you know, the fact that his energy bills, which were stolen, I guess, out of, you know, a recycling bin or something, they got a hold of Al Gore's electricity bills some years ago. And they said, oh, look how much electricity he uses. Well, it turns out he runs his entire operation, not just Al Gore, but the climate organization that he runs out of his own home. And so it's not just Al Gore, it's actually a whole operation that he runs out of his home. And he, in fact, purchases offsets for the electricity that he does use and does use renewable energy to the extent possible. So, you know, but if they can get us focusing on this stuff, then, hey, it's great because it deflects attention from the needed solutions. It divides us. It gets us arguing with each other. And it helps invalidate some of our most important thought leaders and, you know, those who really have a platform that they can use to help communicate the climate crisis.
Exactly. And I want to say I actually am a climate reality leader. I took the training this year, which was all done online with about 10,000 other people. And it was really terrific.
Yeah. And that's spearheaded by Al Gore. Absolutely. And he's done so much, to really further public understanding.
Climate scientist and author Michael Mann. We'll talk more about his new book, The New Climate War, after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with Michael Mann about his new book, The New Climate War. It's about all the ways the fossil fuel industry and petrostates like Russia and Saudi Arabia seek to discredit, divide, and deflect the movement to save the climate, to save our climate. So let's now talk about the price on carbon, because this is another area where I really learned a few things. You advocate carbon pricing, and you also have some criticism for those on the left who are on the left who criticize it. So first of all, let's explain it. I mean, there's cap and trade, there's a carbon tax and dividend, or carbon fee and dividend, and there are carbon credits. You know, the devil's in the detail, and some, including myself, have opposed a bill that was proposed that would prevent suing the fossil fuel companies. I'll get back to that. First, tell us about those methods, but briefly, so that we can really kind of get into the controversy over it.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea is that this is one of the tools in the toolbox. If we want to reduce carbon emissions, there are both demand side ways of doing that, reduce demand for fossil fuel energy, and supply side, preventing the additional construction of infrastructure, fossil fuel infrastructure, blocking, new pipelines, oil drilling, et cetera. And both of those, in my view, are critical, demand side, supply side. Among the demand side measures, you know, you want to level the playing field, because right now fossil fuels are artificially cheap, because what's not in the price tag is the damage that they're doing to the planet when you burn those fossil fuels, when you use those fossil fuels. So they're artificially cheap, which means that it's sort of an unfair competition when it comes to renewable energy that isn't doing the same damage to the planet. You know, that damage from fossil fuels needs to be internalized into the price, so that renewable energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy, so that there will be more demand for renewable energy and less demand for fossil fuel energy. And there are different ways of doing that. You can provide explicit subsidies for fossil fuels, and you can also put a price on carbon, a tax. It can be a carbon tax, you know, that producers, oil producers, coal, oil, natural gas, there's a tax on those energy sources, or emissions permits, that what we call tradable emissions permits, otherwise known as cap and trade, where there's a certain amount of carbon that's allowed to be burned, and you require the fossil fuel companies to purchase those permits, and they can buy and sell those permits. And it puts a cap on the total amount of carbon that can be sold and burned. And that cap can ultimately be lowered and lowered until there you disallow all fossil fuel burning. Those are two different ways of putting a price on carbon. And, you know, I don't see my role as sort of micromanaging how we go about doing that. But I do think that some sort of carbon pricing is a critical tool in the toolbox to reduce demand for fossil fuels. So the politics of it is sort of this. It's a market mechanism for dealing with an environmental externality, as we call it. It's similar to what we did with the acid rain, where there were tradable emissions permits. Cap and trade was actually developed for the acid rain problem. You know, these are market mechanisms for dealing with this environmental crisis. And if you, for example, don't buy into market economics, if you think that market economics is problematic, that capitalism itself is the problem, then I suppose it sort of leads you potentially to think of market mechanisms as being problematic. And so I think there's sort of this growing aversion to capitalism writ large that has led to an opposition within a sector of the sort of progressive movement opposition to these market mechanisms like carbon pricing. But they're an essential tool, as I said, in the toolbox. And we have to use all of the tools available to us if we are to reduce demand quickly, which is necessary to keep warming below catastrophic levels. And I think that there are some environmental groups and some environmental advocates who have been somewhat misguided in their opposition to carbon pricing, because it really is an area where there can be a consensus among environmental advocates on the left and among moderate conservatives who don't want to be on the wrong side of this problem and believe in, for example, using market mechanisms to solve this problem. There's a middle ground that can be reached. I think that's critical given the political outlook that we now have here in the United States, where at least over the next 2 years, we are going to have a perfectly divided Senate, 50-50 Republican-Democrat. The majority leader will be the Democrat because the tie-breaking vote goes with a Democratic vice president. But nonetheless, it will be a closely divided Senate. And it's difficult to see something as expansive as a Green New Deal pass this Congress. On the other hand, it is possible to see a handful of moderate Republicans of good faith crossing the aisle and joining with Democrats to pass some sort of consensus compromise climate legislation, which would almost certainly include carbon pricing as one of its mechanisms. So the path forward, at least over the next few years here in the United States, almost certainly involves carbon pricing. And I hope that environmental progressives will get behind that and recognize that's one of the tools in the toolbox. It isn't the only tool. We need stimulus. We need green stimulus. We need to block the additional infrastructure of pipelines. And the Biden administration has indicated that they are planning to use executive power to do those things. We're going to need all those tools.
Yeah. And you know, I'm one of the people who feels that capitalism, at least the form that we have now, you know, which is really extractive capitalism, is long-term incompatible with the health, the environmental health of the planet. But it is the system we have, and we don't have much time. And if you can use market forces, you know, you can apply levers that can buy us time to make the longer-term transitions we ultimately will probably have to do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, yes, there are larger questions about sort of our sustainability as a civilization in an extractive economy when we have a finite planet and nearly 8 billion people competing for finite food and water and space and dealing now with pandemics like the one that we're currently facing. It really exposes our vulnerability and the need to fundamentally rethink whether, you know, our current path is a sustainable path. We have to have those larger conversations. That having been said, as you say, the climate crisis is a problem that we have to solve within the next 10 years, in essence. We have to act immediately. And we can't wait for some of the larger cultural and economic and societal changes that we might ultimately like to see. We can't wait for all of that to play out before we act on the climate crisis. So we do have to act within the system that exists while working to change that system and to make it better.
We're talking with world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann about his new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Yeah, and so now to that, you know, I have been feeling pretty despairing for quite a long time. And there are, you know, there is a whole kind of, you know, a whole kind of development of doomsayers. Deep adaptation is a new thing. Oh, you know, we have to give up, you know, that basically we are doomed and we just have to adapt as best as we can. You, first of all, say, no, that's not true. We are not doomed. We have time. And here are the things that we can do to do that, that it's possible. So in the minutes that we have left, please give us some hope.
Yeah, thanks, Francesca. It's a really important part of the message of the book that we not fall into doom and despair. And, you know, the inactivists, the bad actors that we've been talking about, they would like nothing more than to see environmental activists fall into despair. Because, look, they've already sort of marshaled the political right. They've weaponized them for their agenda. It would be the ultimate victory if they could weaponize at least a sector of the left for their agenda as well. And the way they do that is by convincing environmental activists, people of good faith and goodwill, convincing them that, hey, it's too late now to do anything about the problem. If they can lead you down that, you know, that path of despair, despondency, doomism, it ultimately leads to the same place, inaction. They don't care about the path that you take to inaction. They just care about the destination. And if doomism is the way to lead you there, the forces of inaction would happily have you follow that path. And so they have sort of thrown fuel on the fires of doomism. And I document in the book how certain conservative and fossil fuel funded interests have actually promoted this doomism because they're aware that it's disabling, that it depresses enthusiasm for action. And again, there are people of goodwill who fall into the trap, who rightfully are a bit despondent that we haven't yet taken the actions necessary to really confront this problem, but wrongly come to believe that that somehow means it's too late. And the science just does not support that view. The doomist narratives like the deep adaptation that you talked about and so many other versions of the doomist narrative, the climate doomist narrative, are typically premised on bad science. Science that's as bad as the distortions that climate change deniers use to deny climate change. For example, the idea that there's so much methane in the Arctic permafrost and we've already warmed up enough that it's all going to be released into the atmosphere and lead to runaway warming. There's literally no evidence for that at all. The science doesn't support that at all. There is some permafrost methane. Some of it will be released as we continue to warm. It's called a carbon cycle feedback. It does increase the warming, but it's taken into account in the model simulations. And it's a small contribution compared to the carbon pollution that we are producing by burning fossil fuels. So ironically, the only way to avoid that additional amplifying effect is to stop warming the planet by burning fossil fuels. And doomism potentially leads us down the opposite path of not taking the actions necessary. And that's what's so damaging, for example, about the messaging around movements, these sort of cult movements. And it is a cult movement like deep adaptation that tell you, hey, you know, just get off the grid and, you know, go north. Go out to the country. You know, it's sort of like doomsday prepper mentality that just drop out of society because it's too late. There's nothing you can do to stop this. Save yourself. It's extremely damaging. And the science, again, doesn't support it. In fact, one of the things that I emphasize in the book, and I've been emphasizing recently in a lot of my public outreach on climate, because it's so important, the last decade of climate science has led to somewhat of a revolution in our understanding of what's known as committed warming. The question is, if we stop burning carbon right now, what happens to the climate? How much additional warming do we get? And the thinking used to be that we were sort of stuck with several decades of additional warming in the pipeline, even if we stop burning carbon. And that was an artifact of the way we used to do climate experiments where carbon dioxide was treated as a control knob and you turn it up and things warm up. And if you stop turning it up, the climate still warms up because of what we call committed warming. The oceans continue to gradually warm up because of what we call thermal inertia in response to the carbon that's already been emitted. And that's a real effect. But there's another effect that wasn't taken into account. And only when we do more realistic climate modeling experiments do we now understand this. If you stop burning carbon right now, dumping carbon pollution into the atmosphere, well, the climate system actually continues to take carbon out of the atmosphere. It draws down carbon dioxide, in particular the oceans absorb carbon dioxide. They take it out of the atmosphere. And so when we do experiments where we allow the oceans and the biosphere to be interactive components in the system, and we specify the amount of carbon pollution put into the atmosphere, what we find is that when you stop putting carbon into the atmosphere, yes, you get that committed warming, that thermal inertia, which all else being equal would cause additional warming for several decades. But offsetting that is the fact that the oceans and the biosphere are pulling that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. CO2 levels start dropping in the atmosphere. Those two effects almost perfectly cancel. And so what it means is that when you stop emitting carbon, surface temperatures flatline. They stop increasing. So there's an immediate and direct impact of our actions. Now, there are some other longer legacy components of the climate system that continue to respond. The ice sheets may continue to lose ice. Sea level may continue to rise. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna. There are still some very troubling committed impacts. But the warming of the surface of the planet and all of the effects that that has stabilizes very quickly. And that really grants us agency. It means that our actions have a direct impact. And that's an important part of the story because it is a reason for cautious optimism, especially at a time when a whole bunch of favorable factors are coming together. The youth climate movement, which is really recentered our attention on the ethical obligation not to destroy this planet for our children and grandchildren, the awareness of climate impacts because of the direct consequences that we are now seeing play out in real time, destructive weather events that we understand are a consequence of climate change, and a favorable shift in the political winds, where there's now here in the United States, suddenly a political environment that will support action on climate. These things have all come together to make this a very favorable moment in time. It would be the worst possible time for us to lose hope. And that's probably the closing message of my book.
Well, that's terrific. And not to speak of the fact that we have the technological capacity right now to, some say, get 100% by 2030, 100% renewable, and you say even 80% by 2030 would get us a way long way to do that. I just want to thank you so much. Michael Mann, you are one of the most important voices, one that I have been personally so grateful for, that you exist on this planet. And this book, The New Climate War, I just cannot recommend it enough. It is a terrific read. It has a huge amount of information, and it is all very engagingly presented. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It was a real honor and joy to talk with you, and I look forward to doing so again in the future.
Author and climate scientist Michael Mann. To see the Crying Indian ad he spoke about, go to writersvoice.net. Next up, the COVID-19 stimulus. Will it be strong enough? Go bold and go bold now. That's what the American people are telling President Biden and the Congress when it comes to COVID-19 relief. $2,000 relief checks, 74% favor them. Raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour? 58% favor that. But GOP senators are either dead set against COVID relief or have offered a paltry package, less than one-third that proposed by Biden. And some centrist Democrats might be enabling them. So what should Biden do? For advice, we turn to political correspondent John Nichols. His February 3rd post in The Nation is titled, "Cutting $2,000 Payments and Limiting Who's Eligible for Them is Bad Economics and Loser Politics." Well, John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice. You start out with this piece, I just have to quote it because your language is just great. The same cabal of compulsive neoliberals and centrist grifters who derailed meaningful progress in previous Democratic administrations are at it again. So tell us who they are.
Well, they're not just Republicans. That's an important thing to understand. There are Democrats and Republicans who buy into a theory that you can never really solve problems, that at the end of the day, all you can do is maintain the status quo and maybe ease the pain, but not go to the heart of the matter. And the way this works is that when the United States gets itself into a very, very difficult position, be it with a stock market collapse or a meltdown in the housing market, or in this case, a pandemic and the economic downturn that extends from it, it's very clear what you should do. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt did in the Great Depression. You spend your way out of the crisis. It's smart, right? But there are people who will always tell you that you can't do that, that you've got to keep the books balanced, that you have to avoid spending at the level that is necessary. And at the end of the day, what happens is that too frequently Democrats accept these arguments coming from mostly Republicans, but also some Democrats, and they end up constraining their governance in a way that ultimately causes people to resent them. And that's what I mean by loser politics.
You call on the GOP side, you say, well, of course, they're probably the majority of GOP senators who will never vote for anything that Biden would put forward. But then the Obstruction Caucus, who have presented a bill that is less than a third of what Biden has suggested. What do you feel is their motivation? Are they really trying to tinker around the edges and solve problems?
It's a very good question, and I think their motivation is twofold. First and foremost, I think that some of them do sincerely believe in a sort of austerity approach, and it's rooted in a very elitist, very privileged way of thinking as regards the role of government. And their sense is that government exists to make sure that wealthy people have the resources that they need to manage the economy. And what they basically play that out through what Reagan and others refer to as trickle-down economics, right? The idea that you would make the rich really rich, and then some of that would trickle down to the rest of us. And that's clearly a big touchstone for a lot of Republicans. And they're wrong, but not necessarily fully evil in that, right? So that's one component. But then there's an evil side as well. And this is not to be underestimated. And that is, frankly, that I don't think there's any question that there are many Republicans who want Democratic presidents to fail. They may, you know, talk a good line at a press conference or something like that. But the truth is brought out by the record of, you know, what happened after Barack Obama became president. And you had a meeting with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and others, and their strategy that they developed on the night that Obama became president was, you know, how do we undermine him? How do we obstruct him sufficiently so that this very popular new president doesn't succeed? And I don't for a second believe that these folks have changed in their mentality. And so I am quite sure that there are many of these Republicans who are, quote unquote, negotiating with Biden, who are doing so with an eye toward assuring that he isn't that successful as a president.
What is the remedy? What can Democrats do? I mean, they have two ways open to them. There's budget reconciliation and there's ending the filibuster. So let's take the first one first. Talk about budget reconciliation and, you know, what can it do and what can't it do?
Budget reconciliation can do some very big things, but it can't do everything. And the way to understand budget reconciliation is that it's an old law, better part of 50 years old. And it was essentially passed to get around presidents messing with things. But one of the key elements of it is it said that on certain budgetary items, in order for the House and Senate to move quickly and effectively on major issues and to put their imprint on those issues, they can develop essentially a fast track. And that fast track allows them to identify something that is clearly budgetary, clearly financial, and say, this is essentially an emergency. So if the House and Senate can agree on what they're doing, they can move it through without having to get super majorities or, frankly, jump through a lot of the traditional hoops. Shorthand, it allows you to go around the filibuster. So that's effective. That means that for instance, Budget Committee Chair Bernie Sanders could develop out a measure in cooperation with the Biden administration, perhaps through this $1.9 trillion relief package, and they could get it through with 50 Democratic votes and Kamala Harris breaking the tie. All the Republican obstruction is tossed aside. So that's a very effective thing. The problem with budget reconciliation is you can only do that on a narrow set of budgetary issues. And you are always sort of walking the tightrope on whether you're within the parameters of it. And so it's not really a replacement for filibuster reform. You still need to get rid of the filibuster as it's currently abused and either eliminate it altogether or, to my preferred model, move toward the traditional idea of the filibuster, which is the talking filibuster. And that is that if someone for a principled reason wants to oppose a bill, or even a group of senators want to oppose a bill, you know, if they're willing to get up and talk for 24 or 36 hours on the floor of the Senate, that's great. I don't have a problem with that because they may touch the hearts or the minds of the American people and cause a shift in the political process. So I'm willing to accept that kind of filibuster, but that's not what we have now. What we have now is simply a bureaucratic tool that a minority party can use to prevent action, not just for 24 or 36 hours, but for days, weeks, months, even years. And so, to my mind, they really do need to do filibuster reform, and I favor that as the ultimate solution to the problem.
And that kind of filibuster, does that mean that they would talk for, you know, an extended period of time, but then it would still go to a vote and a majority could win without the two-thirds majority needed?
Without the 60-vote majority. Yeah, exactly. The talking filibuster, the historic concept of the talking filibuster was that an individual senator could get up and object and talk until they collapsed. You know, it's Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith goes to Washington. That's the concept, right? And remember the theory of Jimmy Stewart was that, you know, he got up and gave that speech. People listened to it on the radio, the Boy Scouts across the country rallying, and ultimately they got some action. You know, they got a message to senators that they needed to do things differently. That I don't mind because I don't want to shut down those who dissent, those who disagree for principled reasons. It's often happened in the past. You know, Robert M. La Follette sought to filibuster the rush into World War I as an example. But that, again, isn't what we have now. What we have now is a bureaucratic abuse that is so grotesque. It literally allows a Senate aide, not even a senator, to call in to a hotline and say, yeah, I'm filibustering. And then suddenly it can make a bill stop. It allows the minority party to prevent action, even if they only have 41, 42 senators. And that's an absurd construct because it does away with majority rule. And frankly, it does away with a functional Senate. Our Senate has not functioned in recent decades, and it's a mess. And so there's a desperate need for filibuster reform. The Senate really does need to be reformed.
That was John Nichols. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his article in The Nation. Cutting $2,000 payments and limiting who's eligible for them is bad economics and loser politics. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.